M37, number 4B.
All right, then we go to the next paragraph. You say that you have not slept well or have overeaten. You are a law unto yourself. Can you see now? Here comes now in that we are a law unto yourself. We decide on the state of our own being. Huh? We are the father, the creator of our own existence, so to say, of how we feel. Saying this and believing it, you will suffer in proportion to your belief and fear. See, in proportion to. So either we can multiply it, augment it, or diminish it, according to our own belief. We are the father of our own destiny. Your sufferings are not the penalty for having broken a law of matter. This is terrific to see, huh? We can break laws of matter right and left and not to fall under penalty if without sin, huh? If by doing right. And for it is a law of mortal mind which you have disobeyed. So we are allowed to disobey a law of mortal mind. Actually, we should, huh? We should. You say or think, because you have partaken of salt fish, that you must be thirsty, and you are thirsty accordingly, while the opposite belief would produce the opposite result. Can you see the law of life here? What we believe in, that will be the result. That's the law of life, huh? We are the father of our own universe. If we believe in this way or in that way, we always determine our own status, ourselves. So what did we have when we made our exercise? We also had things like that. Some of them were saying that, we did say we multiply our own beliefs and the belief in penalty according to into how many beliefs we believe. Huh? The more beliefs we establish, the more we can break those beliefs and to break the beliefs. If we believe in everything regarding food and air and weather and etc., then naturally we can break more beliefs. The less we establish beliefs, the less we can break them. So life gives us here the same tone. Let's go to the next one. Any supposed information coming from the body or from inert matter, as if either were intelligent, is an illusion of mortal mind, one of its dreams. Then comes the point, realize that the evidence of the senses is not to be accepted in the case of sickness any more than it is the case of sin. Can you see? Don't accept penalty, huh? Don't accept you are penalized. It's a question of rejecting it or accepting it. We had a little bit different. I think what we did was even better. We said, let's affirm that we can never be subject to the law of penalty, deny the law of penalty, that there is power in the law of penalty, and so we stressed that tone of truth very much. When we come to love, expose the body to certain temperatures, and belief says that you may catch cold and have catarrh. Can you see, just a side note, can you see that over these two pages, she's talking always about the same subject? That is the first thing we have to see. It's always about the subject, can we be penalized? That must first be clear, you see, in order to read the textbook. Could you see that all these paragraphs, though they take in a lot of issues and side remarks and explanation, that it is all about the same theme, the same subject, namely about penalty. Did you feel that? So here, again, she takes up the same thing. Expose the body to certain temperature, and belief says that you may catch cold and have catarrh. But no such result occurs without mind to demand it and produce it. Again, you have that sense of the fatherhood, that it is really the human mind that demands it and produces it. So long as mortals declare that certain states of the atmosphere produce catarrh, fever, rheumatism, or consumption, those effects will follow. They really realize themselves, they fulfill themselves. Not because of the climate, but on account of the belief. Again, you have a sense that the belief will have its own fulfillment. The author has in too many instances healed disease through the action of truth on the minds of mortals and the corresponding effects of truth on the body, not to know that this is so. What does she really say here about penalty? I think she wants to say that she proved it so often that she knows that this belief that, or the to deny that belief, to overcome that belief, is really that she has overcome it in so many instances that she knows that she has handled the universal claim of penalty. Perhaps this last paragraph is perhaps not so clear as the other ones. When we did our exercise, we just felt as a central point what we wanted to bring out is that the belief in penalty is a universal belief, and that we better don't accept it, because love accepts only loveliness. So, would you feel we have done pretty good? Our findings were not so far away from the way Mrs. Eddy has presented it, and naturally she could also have taken in various other aspects. Now, I must say something as we were reading this, that perhaps not every paragraph was so crystal clear as our epitomes which we made. We tried to make very short epitomes, you know, just in one line sentence, so to say. Whereas here, she will use a whole paragraph, half a page, to explain that. And therefore, it is not so crystallized what we have done, what she writes, compared with what we have done. And the reason for it is that here, her subject of penalty is just a subtone. It's not really the main issue, because she is speaking here in the chapter on practice. She is actually, her main subject is not penalty, but her main subject is truth and mind. It's that part in the chapter where she wants to show what is the truth that we should know. And as a subtone of that truth and mind, she has the subtone of love. You know, she goes through truth and mind as a part, and then shows truth and mind as mind, truth and mind as spirit, truth and mind as soul, truth and mind as principle, truth and mind as life, truth and mind as truth. And then finally, that's what we have been reading, truth and mind as love, and has taken up the belief in penalty. So, in the text, naturally, we have mainly the tone of truth and mind. And therefore, you had all over the place always truth and mind coming in. And so don't let yourself be detracted from the subject of penalty here by bringing in truth and mind. I don't know if I explained that clear enough, just right off the cuffs or not. I only want to show you that while I was reading, I felt that perhaps you would say, but here she's not talking about life, but she's talking about the law of mortal mind, huh? And correcting one's thought and so on. Naturally, this is because the whole overtone is truth and mind, namely knowing the truth. Knowing mind, the truth. But knowing the truth about what? Knowing the truth about penalty. So the text is much more complicated. It's much more like a symphony than just a simple single melody which we, in our exercise, have written down. Yeah. Are you happy about it? You don't seem to be happy. Corey, think what you have been doing. You know why? That's what I said when I started this morning. I said I want to make an experiment. I'm not going to tell you what it is. Well, the experiment naturally was that very thing that I wanted to show you, that somehow, in the measure, as we begin to have a good grasp of the seven synonymous terms and know how to blend them, that actually we can write down what Mrs. Eddy also has written down. Because she couldn't take her textbook from no other place than from the seven synonymous terms. She had no other source. All she could have is that she had a more workable, a more refined sense of the seven synonymous terms, therefore had a finer structure, just as I showed now, that it is the structure of truth and mind in its subtones as love, that she presented penalty, and therefore has had a bit a more exquisite, a more refined structure than what we did. But that actually, that if we have a knowledge of the seven synonymous term, we should be able, tone-wise, tonality-wise, to write the textbook. I hardly dare to say that, what I said. That doesn't, you see, I just can't see how naturally then the critics come and say, well, Max wants to write a new textbook and he thinks he can do it better than Mrs. Eddy and so on. But I think you are quite aware that that is not in my mind. But what I wanted to show is that Mrs. Eddy did take her revelation from the same source to which we can go. And the more we culture that source, those seven synonymous terms, the more natural they will flow to us too. And they can't show another calculus than the divine calculus of the synonymous terms. Second, I think what I wanted to show with that is that in the measure as we culture this synonymous term and the blending and can listen in tones, that in that measure we can read the textbook more intelligently. Reading now these 2.5 pages as we have done, we have already read it differently than you have read it all your life before. Isn't that so?
Yeah.
Because you have been reading those pages before. And I'm quite sure that you have not been aware that she's speaking in those 2.5 pages about the one and the same subject, penalty. And that you have not been aware that she is trying to show penalty as a counterfeit of love. And you may not have been aware of it, that as a counterfeit of love, she was trying to show that subject in seven subtones. And you see, in this way, you begin to structure your consciousness and begin to read structurally. You begin to read the textbook structurally. These 2.5 pages is an example that now, when you close the textbook and you walk home, you can say, now, what was really in that textbook? What was in those 2.5 pages? And without opening the textbook, you can now somehow recapitalize in your own mind the theme of it, how the theme runs. You would know the theme runs from penalty as mind, from penalty as spirit, as soul, as principle, life, truth, and love, and you can reconstruct without having a good memory, without having any memory. The only memory you would have had is to go through the word order to know how the word order runs. And then re-enliven, so to say, in your consciousness that you apparently must say something about penalty in mind, that mind says that penalty is nothing but just the belief of the human mind, that it doesn't come from God Almighty, that it doesn't come from God, that it isn't caused by God, that law of penalty. It's caused by the human mind. And that will say in spirit, you can now go through it with me, and you know it, and I just talk it loud out, what you think yourself, huh? And you know now, going home on that way, you know, oh, she says, and afterwards in spirit, you can break any laws of matter, and not to believe that you will be penalized. As long as you do right, no law of matter can penalize you. And you go to the third and soul, and you see soul is that which is supreme. Therefore, if I am in my consciousness right above that whole belief in penalty, nothing can touch me. It doesn't touch me in the slightest. All that will happen is that sin will fall back on itself and penalize itself. And you go to principle and see, because it's principle, it's impersonal, and therefore it said, as long as you obey the principle, everything is okay with you. You don't have to fear any penalty. By doing right and by doing your duty and by being in obedience with principle, nothing can happen to you. No other law of matter or penalty can do anything to you. And you go to life and say to life, all right, who is actually producing all these beliefs in penalty? I produce them. I bring them forth. And I'm jolly, rather dumb if I produce them. I better don't produce them. I better don't establish beliefs and belief in a belief. And so, in that way, you begin to see, I can free myself because I'm the originator, the father of my own beliefs, and therefore of my own state of being. And you go to truth and say, well, truth is certainly that which does affirm its own truth, and therefore does not affirm the law of penalty. Certainly not. So I'm not going to affirm that there is a law of penalty. I deny that law of penalty. And in love I come to the conclusion that whole belief in penalty is a universal belief, and I can demonstrate it in any case that penalty is not working. Can you see that? See, can you see what structure does? Huh? How wonderful it is to have an ordered sense. Now think of it, that this is the chapter on practice, and the chapter on practice is a chapter that every Christian scientist who has been in the church for 40 years has read about 400 times. Because he goes to that chapter on practice every time, perhaps he's in trouble, and reads it. What have you read? What have you read? Without structure, you never have really known what you have read. You have known the sentences. Yes, that you have known. Huh? Rise in the strength of spirit, to resist everything that is unlike God. That you have, but that's argumentation. That's atomistic treatment. But think of the beauty that the textbook yields the moment we begin to see that whole thing in order and in structure. And have you seen how simple actually the textbook is, and becomes simpler and simpler the clearer we see the tones of the synonymous terms? And you read it easier, very easy. Well, I would like if you would agree with that. Yeah. Huh? Yeah. Yes? I think, you see, that's what we would like to achieve. Huh? Think. I have taken now here just those 2.5 pages to show. Now, next week when we do the whole textbook, it's nothing else, but just in a large way, 600 pages instead of 2 pages, showing that the story is always repeating itself. That there is just one thing going on, namely the 7 synonymous terms, and according to what other angle we take in. If we take in the angle of the Word as the Word, or the, take in the angle of the Word as the Christ, those seven get a different shade. That's all. But they are still the seven. And so it reduces itself always more and more just to simplicity. Yes? So I've shown you the tonality through the text of the textbook. And I think if a class has done an exercise very well, when I was in school, the teacher said, I'm going now to give you something for it. I'm going to read you a story for it. And so I will read you this afternoon, the whole afternoon, I will read you from the Bible. Yeah? So I don't know if you should need the Bible or not need the Bible. Actually, I don't think you need it, except if I pronounce my English words wrongly. But I want once this afternoon to read from the Bible, just to read, and let you listen to the tonality. That would be now a step further, naturally. You see, now we had the tonality in the textbook with terms that are familiar to us because of our list of ideas. Now, the Bible doesn't use those terms always. They use quite different terms. They use images of nature, of history, and so on. And so we want to see if we could catch the tonality of the seven through the Bible. So you have an easy afternoon. I will have to work.
Good.